Hi, this is Mike Morford. You may know me as co-host of the true crime podcast Criminology. I'd like to invite you to listen to one of my other podcasts called The Murder of My Family. In each episode of The Murder of My Family, I discuss a murder case and include an interview with a family member of the victim to discuss the aftermath of the murder in an attempt to view these crimes from a unique perspective, one that we don't usually experience. Some of the cases I cover are well known, while others you've probably never heard of. I currently have dozens of episodes available for you to binge on, including episodes about the Golden State Killer, the Delphi Murders, and the Colonial Parkway Murders, just to name a few. Here's a small sample of the kind of conversations you'll hear on The Murder of My Family.
Mike, at the risk of sounding like every other proud big brother around the world, Kathy was an amazing person. She was 27 years old at the time of her death, and she'd already accomplished a great deal.
One point that I wanted to get across was that the victims whose murders I discuss aren't just statistics or a blurb in a news report. These were real people whose murders affected their family members, forever changing their lives. It's important to know that they too are victims.
For me, knowing that he has a family and that he gets to see his kids every day and that he gets to be there for his kids growing up, like, it's not fair. You know, my dad did everything he was supposed to do as a father and as a husband, and someone decided that night that he didn't get to do that anymore. It's frustrating knowing that, you know, he'll get to see his kids grow up and graduate and get married and do all that, and my dad doesn't get to do any of those things. He doesn't get to see his... He has three granddaughters now that he'll never see, and they'll never meet their grandfather, and it's just... It's not fair.
New episodes of The Murder of My Family come out every other Saturday, and you can find The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Being lesbian, transgender, gay, queer, bisexual, or anything other than heterosexual in the 80s and 90s were scarier times than they are today, which isn't saying a ton. In the UK, laws were extremely strict at the time about sexual activity among those of the same gender. There was Section 28, which was very vague, saying promotion of homosexuality was against the law. This applied mostly to schools having conversations or reading material that involved anything having to do with same-sex relationships. However, the court could ultimately decide what the word promotion meant. Before September of 1992, same-gender sexual activity was not legal, and the age of consent between two people of the same gender was 21, which wasn't reduced to 18 years old until 2001. That still was not equal to the heterosexual age of consent, which was 16 until 2006. The UK in the early 90s was not very accepting of the LGBTQ+ community, especially when AIDS began to spread. It was even called the Gay Plague. The media would never publish news stories about anyone under the LGBTQ+ umbrella unless it was in a negative light, and the police were not kind to them either. So, as you can imagine, when crimes or murders happened to a person who was not heterosexual, coming forward with any helpful information as a gay person could have been incriminating. Therefore, it wasn't until after September of 1992, when same-gender sexual activity was decriminalized, that people of the LGBTQ+ community felt comfortable to speak out more about information they knew regarding criminal activity. This played a big role in the case I'll be telling you about today. The victims were gay men, and it was purposeful, as the killer knew anyone gay who may have suspected anything would be too scared to go to the police with information. Let's get started. A 17-year-old girl who was a news agent's assistant had a baby boy named Colin Ireland on March 16, 1954 at the West Hill Hospital in Dartford, Kent, England. The father of Colin abandoned him and his mother before he was even born, and Colin never knew who his father was. As a teenage mom, she was struggling to make ends meet for her and her little boy. She and Colin were bad off financially, and they constantly moved from one home to another. His mother tried hard to make a good life for Colin, but his childhood was filled with dysfunction, anxiety, and disruption. Colin's mother was barely making ends meet, but her parents took her and Colin in. For 5 years, the two stayed there, but in 1959, his mother was ready to spread her wings and strived to be an independent woman. She and Colin moved to Birch Road, Gravesend. For the duration of the next few years, Colin and his mother moved around at least 9 times, as she also worked many part-time, low-paying jobs. Within a year, things were just not working out the way his mother planned. She tried her best to make a good life for Colin, but she could not do it alone. In 1960, they continued to move around until they went to West Malling. This was a place for homeless women and children, but it was described as being more like a jail. It was a campground of wooden huts that they stayed in for a few months, but Colin's mother decided this was not the place for them and moved back in with her family. In 1961, when Colin was around 7 years old, his mother had a significant other. The three moved to Dartford and stayed there for approximately 3 years. Eventually, his mother and this man got married. As great as this man was to Colin and his mother, he was an electrician by trade, but wasn't very responsible. He would only work here and there. Due to this, their little family was not in the best financial situation, and again, struggling to make ends meet. All of this moving around when Colin was only a little boy became really difficult for him because not only was he moving from home to home, but he was also moving from school to school, and he could not make friends. From 5 years old to 10 years old, he had gone to at least 6 different schools. The children always called him the new kid or the odd one out. Due to him being skinny, lanky, and bow-legged, the kids were verbally cruel towards him and harassed him constantly. It got to be too much, and his mother let him stay home from school a lot of the time, so he would not have to deal with the bullies. When he did show up to school, if he was a little late, the punishment for that was getting a spanking with a cane. Much later, looking back on this, Colin said, quote, "The punishment for repeated lateness was the cane. I'm surprised that I grew up to be a sadist and not a masochist." Due to Colin missing so much school, he had a difficult time getting through high school. He became depressed, withdrawn, and he was left out and not invited to any activities that his peers were doing. Colin acted much younger than his age, and he was not athletic, so he was never picked for sports activities at school. One thing he was proud of at that age was being a member of the Sea Cadets for 2 years. Prior to high school, when Colin was 10 years old, his mother and stepfather were kicked out of their home because they could not make the rent payments. Colin and his mother went back to the homeless shelter for women and children. No men were allowed there, so Colin's stepfather went to his parents' home to live. In late 1964, Colin's mother found out that she was expecting her second baby. She decided to go through with the pregnancy despite not being financially stable. She wanted so badly to make things work no matter what. In trying to make things work with this second baby, she decided to send Colin to live with foster parents in Waynescott, Kent. This was a very ordinary and dull time in Colin's life. After his little brother was born, his mother and stepfather moved to West Kingston, bringing Colin back into the family dynamic to live with them. It wasn't long before his stepfather would walk out on Colin's mother and the children, which not only hurt them emotionally, but also put them in a terrible spot once again monetarily. Through all of the ups and downs, moving from home to home, school to school, homeless shelters, and foster care, Colin loved his mother, and they were close. She was a gentle, affectionate, selfless person who continually made sacrifices for her kids to have food in their stomachs and clothes on their backs. When Colin was around 12 years old in 1966, Colin's mother had fallen head over heels for another man who she eventually married. In the last marriage, Colin had his last name changed to the man's surname, Saker. This time, however, he would not take this new man's name and had his last name changed back to his mother's maiden name, Ireland. The three moved to Sheerness in Kent, where they would live for 5 years. Fortunately, the marriage was stable. Colin's new stepfather was giving, loving, provided for the family, and gave Colin's mother a terrific life. Colin loved going to arcades when he was around 16 years old to hang out with other teenagers, but unfortunately, that was a hot spot for pedophiles in Sheerness, Kent, England. These men would proposition Colin many different times, and they would lurk around the arcade and watch Colin closely. He also worked a summer job at a fair, where many times there were men who also propositioned him. One man approached Colin, saying that he would trade a necklace that he could gift his mother if, in return, Colin would have sex with him. When Colin was 12 years old and using a public restroom, a man, possibly in his early 20s, peeped over the top of the stall and watched Colin, never saying a word. That experience absolutely and understandably creeped Colin out terribly. Another time, Colin was at the movie theater when a local optician walked up to him, begging Colin to participate in sexual acts. One time, Colin was in a secondhand store when a man who worked there hit on him and asked for sexual favors. During every scary encounter, Colin said no and resisted. Nothing sexually ever happened. However, those experiences caused Colin to hold in his anger, confusion, and the feelings of being degraded and violated. He didn't know what to do with those emotional sensations. Those heavy feelings and those emotions would eat at him daily. The overwhelming feelings only got worse as time went on. In 1970, Colin was 16 years old and would begin to start a string of minor crimes. He wasn't happy at home or school. Life was bringing him down, and he ran away to London. He stole the amount of money it would take for him to be able to get there, since he didn't have any money at all. Colin was caught and made to go to Finchton Manor School in Kent. At this school, things were much the same when it came to Colin being teased and bullied relentlessly. Due to his pent-up frustrations of being harassed for years, he caught another kid's belongings on fire intentionally. Thankfully, a teacher was able to put the fire out. Even though this was the first time he had set anything on fire, ever since he was little, he had a fascination with fire, and he would also have bad dreams about fire that would continue throughout his whole life. After this incident, the only consequence he received was being kicked out of the school. Afterwards, Colin made his way back to London with nowhere to live and no money in his pockets. He began to commit robbery until he was caught at 17 years old. He was sentenced and sent to a borstal, which is a reform school that holds 16 to 22-year-olds. The borstal also provided counseling and work training. He absolutely despised the place and ended up making a run for it, but he didn't run for long. The police found him and sent him to the even stricter borstals of Rochester and Grindon to spend the rest of his sentence from 1971 to 1972. Colin was 18 when he was finally free. He was rejected in his attempt to enlist in the French Foreign Legion. The 6'2" young man had then developed a taste for and captivated by paramilitary attire and survivalist training. He would often go camp out on the Essex Moors. When he wasn't in trouble with law enforcement, Colin was working various manual labor jobs. He did meet his first girlfriend not long after he was released, but he was still in a mental state of confusion and misery. Looking back on this time of his life, Colin said, quote, "I was entering what I call the lost period, common to those who suffer from psychopathy. In between custodial periods, a lot of the 70s were a blur. I spent my time detached and wondering." At 21 years old, Colin found himself in hot water, being sentenced to 18 months in prison when he was found guilty of 2 counts of robbery, stealing a car, and damage to property. When he was released the next year, 1976, he made his home in Swindon, Wiltshire, where he would soon meet his second girlfriend, who was the first person he'd ever had sex with. His girlfriend was a black West Indian woman who was around 27 years old and already had 4 children. Colin and his new girlfriend resided together for several months, even planning to get married and what their wedding would be like. However, it just wasn't meant to be. On top of the relationship ending, he wouldn't stop committing crimes, making life even harder on himself. In 1977, he was sentenced to 18 months in prison again, this time for extortion. 3 years later, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for robbery, and in 1981, he was convicted of attempted deception. The next year, Colin married 36-year-old Virginia Zammit, who he had met at a survivalism lecture. They lived in the Holloway area of London and had a little girl together. Virginia was disabled in a wheelchair due to a car accident that paralyzed her when she was 24 years old, and he called himself doing her a favor. 3 years later, in 1985, he was convicted for going equipped to cheat. In this case, to cheat is a criminal offense involving property. He was sentenced to 6 months. Colin had also been stepping out of his marriage, having an affair, and Virginia found out. In 1987, the two divorced. Colin was not a bachelor for long. He met Janet Young. She was the owner of a pub, and Colin was a customer. She lived above the pub with her 2 children, and after a week of knowing each other, Colin moved in with them. Janet's co-workers did not like Colin at all, but she fell for him very fast. Colin tried his hand at being a mixer behind the bar, and after 3 months, the two married. Janet's children adored Colin, and he seemed to love them too. Most people around Holloway knew Colin as the gentle giant, which he was anything but. This episode is sponsored by Athletic Greens. With one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. It's lifestyle friendly. Whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, there's less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no nasty chemicals, or artificial anything, while still tasting good. You'll get better sleep, better recovery, better mental clarity, and alertness. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free year of supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase at athleticgreens.com/emerging. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/emerging to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. This relationship was hostile and volatile. Often, Colin would physically abuse Janet and would steal from her. One night, he kicked Janet out of their bedroom. She went to another room to sleep. He rushed into the room, busting a light bulb as he moved around the room, circling Janet, and in a scary, taunting voice said, "I'm over here. I'm over here." After an Easter Sunday, while Janet was away from home, Colin emptied the house, knew the PIN number to her bank account, and disappeared. When he abandoned Janet and the children, leaving her feeling like she didn't know who he was at all, that he was cold-hearted to do such a thing, she at one point did wonder if he was arrested or maybe he was dead. She didn't know what to think. Colin left his family with hardly any money. Janet was not even able to pay bus fare to get home. When they separated in the early 1990s, sadly, Janet and her children landed on even harder times and lived on the streets. Colin moved to South End-on-Sea, and with nowhere to go, he lived in a hostel, eventually getting his own flat. While he was living in South End-on-Sea, he was frequenting a gay bar in Earl's Court, London, where he became very knowledgeable about gay culture. He became familiar with the sexual signs that people would demonstrate to identify themselves and what they wanted sexually. If someone had a red handkerchief in their left pocket, that meant something. If they were to, say, have a green one in their right pocket, that would mean something else. Colin learned all of these signs and essentially how to weasel his way into that community in a cunning way, and he could easily prey on people. In 1991, Colin applied to be a volunteer at a homeless shelter. This was his way of paying it forward to society and attempting to build a new life and reputation. For 6 months, things were going well, but everyone around him began to complain about his bad manners, homophobia. They feared him, and his behavior was getting unpredictable. The committee decided to let Colin go after there were many complaints about him touching female co-workers, and he was not happy about that one bit. At that point, he felt rejected, not respected. He didn't get the recognition or the pat on the back that he wanted for being a quote-unquote good person, and as if all his volunteer work was for nothing. Colin did, however, start working at a gay bar as a bouncer and would begin to study his potential victims. At the end of 1992, Colin made a New Year's resolution unlike any other. His resolution was to become a serial killer. At 39 years old in 1993, Colin was filled with indignation and anxiety. He had an unhealthy fascination and admiration for serial killers. He would study them for hours on end. He learned about what is known as geographical profiling. Serial killers usually murder their victims around 7 miles from where they live, and investigators, more times than not, can go by that to eventually find the killer. Colin knew that he could not murder that close to his area in Southend-on-Sea, where he was living, and picked London to carry out his New Year's resolution. At the gay pub, Colin was portraying himself as a BDSM dominant figure. 45-year-old Peter Walker was into BDSM and a slave, which is an extremely submissive role as a sex partner. He was also a choreographer. Peter made the mistake of approaching Colin at the bar, and the two hit it off. They ended up leaving together, heading to Battersea, where Peter lived in an apartment. When they arrived, things got sexually heated quickly. Peter consented to what he thought would only be a BDSM kinky sex session. Colin tied together a few condoms and used them to gag Peter. Colin proceeded to get a cord and bind Peter to the post of his bed. It felt like foreplay to Peter in the beginning, but he would soon realize it was not at all. Colin put Peter's dogs in another room, locking the door. He also showed up prepared with items that could be used during a BDSM session. However, he used them in a violent, deadly manner. Colin had cord, a knife, a pair of gloves, and extra clothes. At this point, Peter was bound, trapped, and completely vulnerable. Using a dog lead, a belt, and his fists, Colin began to beat Peter ruthlessly, and when the brutal beating was over, Colin used a plastic bag and put over Peter's head, finishing what he came to do by suffocating his victim. After Peter had died, Colin was curious as to what pubic hair smelled like as it burned. He proceeded to light Peter's pubic hair on fire, just to smell it. Afterwards, he made sure to clean up the apartment and got rid of any evidence that the police may find that would link him to the scene. As he was rifling through Peter's things, he found something that infuriated him to the point he shoved one condom into Peter's mouth and another up his nose. What Colin had found was a test result that Peter was HIV positive. He also put two stuffed teddy bears beside Peter's body, promiscuously in the 69 position. Colin decided to stay the night at Peter's apartment, and the next morning he used the train with the morning rush hour crowd to get home. To get rid of his clothes, gloves, and shoes, Colin tossed them out of the train window near the London transportation system, which he would continue to do throughout his killing spree. Later on that day, he called someone near Peter's home and told them that his dogs needed to be let out of the room that they were in. It wasn't really about releasing the dogs. It was more about the crime scene being discovered. Colin even contacted the Sun newspaper, telling a journalist there were dogs locked in a room at the apartment, and he was the one who killed the man who lived there. He also said he was attempting to become a famous serial killer. When the police arrived, they assumed this was likely a case of S&M sex that went too far, and asked the LGBTQ+ community if they had any information. Since the police and the community did not have a good relationship because authorities would brush off crimes and abuse in their community. There was also a law being passed just one day before Peter's body was found that made S&M sex between consenting adults illegal. Due to this, LGBTQ+ community members did not want to speak out because they could get themselves prosecuted by doing so. After Peter's death, Colin did not commit any killings for 2 months. On May 28, 1993, he went back to the pub on the prowl for another unsuspecting victim. Christopher Dunn was a 37-year-old librarian who expressed to Colin that he was a submissive who craved being dominated. He unfortunately invited Colin to come over to his flat that night and Wildstone. First, the two watched a steamy S&M tape. Then, Colin told Christopher to go to his room and get ready. Colin walked into the bedroom, finding Christopher donning nothing except a studded belt and a body harness. At some point, Colin made Christopher give him his bank card and PIN number, which he would use later. Christopher was told to get on the bed and lie face down, while Colin proceeded to bind his feet together and handcuff his victim. As he did to Peter, he began to beat and torture Christopher and burned Christopher's testicles with a lighter as he suffered. Afterwards, Colin shoved pieces of fabric into Christopher's mouth until he died by asphyxiation. Colin did as before and cleaned the room well, stayed overnight, leaving when he felt it didn't look suspicious, took the train, and threw out everything he had worn during the murder. At the time, Colin was not employed anywhere and was receiving benefits through the state. When he hopped off the train, he went right to the bank and took out £200 from Christopher's account. It wasn't until 2 days after Christopher's death when he was discovered by one of his friends, and yet again, the police brushed it off as S&M gone too far. This time, Colin wasn't going to wait very long to strike again. He was bloodthirsty. On June 4th, 1993, Colin was back at the bar to meet the next man whose life he would take. Perry Bradley III was 35 years old, a businessman from Texas, and his father was a U.S. congressman. That night, the two went to Perry's apartment in Kensington, and Colin sweet-talked Perry into letting him tie him up for some kinky foreplay. Perry did not have any experience when it came to BDSM sex play, and he was standoffish at first. Colin guilted him into going along with it by saying it was necessary in order for him to get off. Perry decided to go along with it, grudgingly, and had no idea he would sadly pay the ultimate price for it. Again, Colin bound Perry as he was laying face down on his bed, and around the neck of the helpless victim, he tied a noose. Perry was forced to tell Colin where his bank card was and what his PIN number was. If he didn't, he was threatened to be burned with a lighter. Colin told Perry to go to sleep, and shockingly, he did. At first, Colin thought about leaving, but he knew he couldn't because Perry could identify him. So while Perry was asleep, Colin tightened the noose gradually until he died. Afterwards, he left a doll on top of Perry's body. Colin went through with his routine cleaning, staying until the next morning with £100 that he had found in Perry's flat, and he went to the bank to take out more money from his account, £200. When police were investigating, they still didn't connect the dots of those three deaths. Needless to say, these deaths were not getting any media attention, and the lack of exposure did not help matters. This also made Colin infuriated, because he wanted the notoriety, the fame, the attention, and 3 days later, the predator was back at it, scouting for his next prey. June 7th, 1993, back to the bar Colin went and met Andrew Collier. Andrew was 33 years old and was a warden at a refuge house development. Colin accompanied Andrew back to his flat in Dalston. Andrew consented to getting tied up and handcuffed to his bed. When Colin insisted Andrew to tell him where his bank card was and tell him the PIN number, Andrew would not tell him. Colin proceeded to loop a noose around Andrew's neck, tightening it with intensity until he died of strangulation. While Colin went rambling around in Andrew's personal belongings, he found the results of an HIV test, which was positive, and Andrew had not told him this information. As in the other murder, where he found the same thing, this enraged Colin even more. I want to warn you now, this is about to involve the killing of an animal. If you'd like to hit the skip button a few times or in the episode now, please do. Colin seemed angrier than ever before, burning several sections of Andrew's body, but he didn't stop there. He took his wrath out on Andrew's cat, strangling it to death. Colin went even further. He had a furious desire to humiliate Andrew's corpse in a way that was extremely disturbing and like nothing he had ever done. Putting a condom on Andrew's penis and another condom on the deceased cat's tail, Colin then opened the cat's mouth and inserted Andrew's penis inside of it and positioned Andrew to put the cat's tail inside of his mouth. The next morning, Colin took the cup he had been drinking out of, 70 pounds he found while ransacking through Andrew's things, and jumped on the train during rush hour as usual. When the authorities discovered Andrew, they connected his murder to Peter Walker's, the first man to lose his life by Colin's hands. The crime scenes were a lot alike, especially with the bizarre use of condoms. While they were in Andrew's flat, they recovered fingerprints from the frame of a window. The police presumed these murders were the sick doings of a serial killer and began to gather a lot of information from locations in London where there were suspicious deaths. Colin wanted the attention, recognition, and infamous reputation so badly that on June 12, 1993, he phoned the Kensington police, informing him he took the lives of 4 men, and they needed to do something to prevent him from continuing his killing spree. If not, there would be 1 victim each week. When he hung up with them, he dialed the police in Battersea. Colin raised a few questions. He wanted to know if they had any concerns about the death of Peter Walker, if homosexuals mattered to them, and asked them why they ceased the investigation into his murder. He told them that he was going to strike again and had forever fancied carrying out the perfect murder. One of the phone calls went as follows. The officer asked, "Why are you doing this?" Colin responded, "Because I set out to see, because I've read several books on serial killers, and you know, I wondered if it could be possibly done and got away with." The officer asked, "But what was your aim in all that?" Colin responded, "Just to see if it could be done, all right? So I'll leave you to get on with it. Bye-bye." That same night, he met 41-year-old Emmanuel Spiteri at the pub, who was a Maltese chef and fond of being fully clad in leather. Colin and Emmanuel took several trains to get to his apartment in Catford. Colin followed his same routine of bounding his victim to the bed, handcuffing him, putting a noose around Emmanuel's neck, and demanded his bank card and PIN number. Afterwards, he killed Emmanuel by strangling him to death with the noose. He cleaned the room and sat down to enjoy some television for a while. Then he did something else he had never done before. Colin made the effort to burn down Emmanuel's apartment, with the hopes and expectations of the whole block going down in a blaze. However, the fire dwindled out in Emmanuel's bedroom. That day, now the 13th of June, he phoned the police again and told them to go to South London and search for a body at the scene of a fire. He kept talking. He told them he had studied and read many books about serial killers, and went on to say that he knew to be categorized by the FBI as a serial killer, he had to take the lives of 5 people, and he could quit killing at this point since he had filled that quota. Colin told the police he just wanted to see if he could actually do it, and since he did, he would probably not kill anyone else. It wasn't until 2 days later, on the 15th, that Emmanuel's landlady found him and alerted the police. Now, Colin Ireland would begin to get what he wanted most of all. The murders were gaining major publicity, and Detective Superintendent Ken John was called on during a press conference, calling for him to report that 5 gay men had been slain and connected pathologically and forensically. The murder of Peter Walker and Andrew Collier were linked almost immediately, but finally, the other 3 men were considered to be possibly connected as well. The detective superintendent did let the LGBTQ+ community know to stay aware, to always be on high alert, and certainly make sure they tell at least 1 friend where they are going to be if they go anywhere with someone they've just met. The detective did allege that the murderer could have AIDS, and these might be revenge killings. June 17, 1993, Detective Superintendent Ken John spoke to the media, begging the perpetrator to turn himself in, that he just wanted to talk to him and get him the help he needs. 2 days later, flyers began to be passed around at the London Gay Pride Festival, where over 50,000 people were present. Authorities passed around these flyers, asking anyone who would listen to spread the word and come forward with any information they may have known about these vicious slayings. Police brought in a psychologist, Dr. Mike Berry, who they asked to assist with profiling this slayer on the loose. Dr. Berry believed whoever the killer was motivated by violent fantasies. No murder this man committed was good enough. It was never like the fantasy in his mind. So the doctor believed he was fueled by the dissatisfaction of his own actions not lining up to what he envisioned. The psychologist also was of the belief that the murderer did not have AIDS, and these were not revenge killings at all like the police first suspected. Dr. Jonas Rappaport, another psychologist, was brought in and agreed with Dr. Berry. Additionally, this psychologist believed the killer was only pretending to be gay to lure in these men. Dr. Rappaport surmised that the killer was very organized and prepared, that he was likely a big, strong man who used that to his advantage to take control and have more power over his victims. Criminal psychologist Paul Britton and Dick Walter also weighed in, as did a former member of the FBI and serial killer specialist Robert Ressler. June 24, 1993, police released a description of a man who was white, anywhere between 30 and 40 years old, a little over 6 feet tall, clean-shaven, a fuller face, short dark brown hair, and stained teeth. This description was given from someone who remembered the man on the train with Emmanuel Spiteri the night that he was killed. Authorities were able to make an electronic facial identification technique which replicated physical looks based on verbal descriptions. July 2, 1993, 10 hours into 450 hours of CCTV footage from the train Emmanuel was on that night, which was one of London's first ever security cameras, police found the man who was accompanying Emmanuel. Police released the photo and urged the perpetrator to turn himself in so he could be questioned. The very next day, the police station's phones were ringing off the hook with over 40 callers, mostly men, saying they'd interacted with the man in question at the Collahern pub. 17 days after his picture was released, Colin went to his lawyer to let him know that he was with Emmanuel the night that he died, and that was him in the picture on the train with him, but he denied being the killer. Colin told his lawyer the night he left Emmanuel's apartment, another man was also there. All of this information, along with the fingerprints the police collected, was sufficient enough for the police to take Colin into custody on July 21, 1993, and he was charged with the murder of Andrew Collier, the man whose apartment was where the fingerprints were lifted from the window frame. Only 2 days later, Colin was charged with the murder of Emmanuel. At this point, he was sent to prison, where he sat and continued to declare that he did not kill these men. There was no trial for Colin Ireland, because while he was in prison, on August 19, 1993, he confessed, with no emotion whatsoever, to the murders of Peter Walker, Christopher Dunn, Perry Bradley III, Andrew Collier, and Emmanuel Spiteri. Colin said he was completely sober during each murder, that he was not gay, but he did work as a bouncer at a gay club at one point. He said he never took the clothes off of the men, never had sex with them, and was not aroused or took any sexual pleasure in these killings. Colin stated he did not have anything against the LGBTQ+ community, and the reason he chose gay men was simple. They were easy targets, kept to themselves, and don't tell the police anything. Intense male perverseness was what he claimed made him so infuriated, and it had to do with the pedophiles that he had come into contact with as a child. Colin claimed he hated these perverted men who were into BDSM and said he was doing society a favor by getting rid of the vermin and longed for the attention and to be recognized as a superior, grander being. During his confession, he stated, quote, "I wasn't forced to do this. In fact, when I was last interviewed by the police for 5 days, I said nothing on tape. I spent a month in prison considering my mental state, my outlook on what happened. I probably didn't come to a final decision until yesterday. I wanted to create a situation where I could not back out of my decision. So I spoke to the prison officers regarding this and said that I was intending to change my plea to a plea of guilty. I think I should be placed in a position where I can no longer inflict harm upon others." Describing one of the murders, he explained, quote, "I tied him up. I went, got a plastic bag from the kitchen, a carrier bag, put it over his head, and I think in a way he wanted to die. He probably didn't realize I detected him in this lack of desire to carry on. I think he knew he was going to die. He was quite controlled about it. It was almost like a thing that was going to happen. Almost like a fate thing." When asked about spending the night with the bodies of the victims, he said, quote, "I think that affected me mentally to quite a degree, sitting with his body for over 5 or 6 hours, watching him gradually get blotches, go cold. It wasn't something that I could cope with, to be honest. I didn't deal with it too well." British author Anna Jacoski, who had interviewed Colin Ireland, said, quote, "In his mind, the homosexual man who indulged in sadomasochism became akin to the pedophile that has a similar relationship with his victim. Both are relationships of power and acquiescence." After talking to Colin, the psychologists believed that the way Colin would put teddy bears, dolls, and the cat onto these men's bodies was a representation of his repugnance that he felt about the loss of innocence as a child. On August 20th, 1993, Colin was charged with all of the murders at the Old Bailey, London, and given 5 life sentences. The judge, Mr. Justice Sachs, said Colin was, quote, "exceptionally frightening and dangerous, and to take one human life is an outrage. To take 5 is carnage." Colin Ireland was on the list of prisoners who would be in prison for the remainder of their natural life. One good thing that came from these tragic events was that it changed the way authorities treated gay victims and investigations were more thorough. Author Paul Burstyn stated, quote, "The fact that we now have LGBT liaison officers, the fact that anti-gay hate crime is actually treated seriously by the police, we see ourselves more as citizens, and we expect to be treated as citizens by the police in a way that we did not before." At 57 years old, on February 21st, 2012, Colin Ireland died in Wakefield Prison in the healthcare center at 9:20 a.m. His cause of death was attributed to pulmonary fibrosis. And that concludes today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe and take care.